So V is going to be a finite dimensional representation of a group G over a field F. So pretty familiar setting in this conference, I think. Let's see, the action of G on V induces an action on the dual vector space, and you extend that to an action on the symmetric algebra, the symmetric powers of the dual. And we choose a basis for the dual, and so we end up with the group acting by a degree-preserving algebra automorphisms on a polynomial ring, right? Linearly on the variables and then algebraically on products. Okay, so the ring of invariants is the set of polynomials fixed by our group action, and where I differ from most of the previous speakers is, in order to make this ring finitely generated, I'm going to assume that the group is finite. So we need some sort of condition, and that's the condition that I'm going to work with. So we have a finite group, and that means that our ring of invariants is finitely generated, and because the group action preserves degrees, we can choose the generators to be homogeneous polynomials, and so everything is going to be graded in homogeneous, and I'll try to mention that as we go along, but if I forget, probably it's sort of a global assumption that we're talking about graded polynomials. You know, we work with the grading, we work with homogeneous polynomials. Now, in fact, for most of the talk, I'm going to look at a rather special situation where the field has characteristic P for some prime number, and the group is actually cyclic. And so this is maybe the natural time for me to point out the term modular in my title. If we're talking about a case where the characteristic of the field divides the order of the group, then we think of the representation as a modular representation, and the corresponding invariant theory we can think of as modular invariant theory. So this is, if we look at a cyclic group of order P in characteristic P, this is the simplest case of modular invariant theory. I guess I justify spending a lot of time on this special case for a couple of reasons. One, it is the simplest case, and yet there are questions we don't understand. Secondly, if you were to look at a general modular representation and attack that, you would probably start by looking at a PC-Luff subgroup. So you would look at a P group. Now, if you want to study a P group, you could look at a composition series, and your quotients are all Z mod Ps. So from a generous point of view, the cyclic group of order P is the building block of the heart of the modular problem. So that's my justification for spending quite a bit of time on this particular rather special case. So just some further notation. Sigma will be the generator of my cyclic group. I'll use delta to denote the difference between sigma and 1. And the trace or transfer, if I call it TR, you can fill in the blank and call it either trace or transfer, is the sum over the group. And we think of these as elements in the group ring. So they have perfectly good existence on their own, but of course we're going to want to think of them as acting on things. But they're in the group ring to begin with. Now, because we're working in characteristic P, we have some interesting formulae for binomial coefficients. So if we take delta to the pth power, we get 0. This is just an exercise in binomial coefficients mod p. And if we take delta to the p minus first power, we get the transfer, which is, again, an exercise in binomial coefficients mod p. So if we're going to talk about the invariant theory, we should know which representations we should be looking at. So we should have a brief word about the representation theory of Z mod P. And here's one of the few cases where the modular representation theory is very straightforward. So we've managed to avoid a lot of the difficulties of modern modular representation theory. So we're talking about a cyclic group, which means we just need to know the Jordan canonical form of the generator. And we know what the eigenvalues have to satisfy. And again, working with binomial coefficients mod p, we see that the only possible eigenvalue is 1, which means that the Jordan form is just determined by the size of the blocks. So we'll let V sub n denote the n-dimensional representation determined by a single Jordan block eigenvalue 1. So that means we have up to isomorphism, this complete list of indecomposable representations of the cyclic group of order P, block 1, block 2, block 3, up to block P. And if you try to write down a block of size P plus 1, you find you have an element of order P squared. So it doesn't fit into the representation theory of that group. So we have P indecomposable representations, and I guess we'll make the remark that the large one is the projective indecomposable. And of course, the small one, the V1, is the one irreducible that you have. Okay, so in principle, what we should do is try to compute rings of invariance for these representations plus direct sums of these representations. So let's look at the simplest interesting example, just to warm up, fairly elementary. We'll take V2, and now the dual is isomorphic to V2, and I'm going to go straight and tell you what the action on the dual is going to be. So I'm sort of shifting my basis a little bit and choosing things so that the sigma acting on the dual is in Jordan canonical form. So I have x1 and x2. Sigma on x1 is x1. Sigma on x2 is x1 plus x2. So that's a nice little 1, 1, 0, 1 matrix if you like to use columns. Now, if we take an orbit product, we get an invariant, and we'll call that the norm, or n. So I can take the orbit product of the one sort of the one variable in which the group acts non-trivially, and by simplifying my, doing a little bit of algebra, I end up with this nice expression, x2 to the p minus x1 to the p minus 1 x2 as the orbit product. So this is just again an exercise in binomial coefficients. You multiply it out and simplify, and this is what you get. So certainly my invariant ring should include x1, which is fixed, and the norm of x2, which is also fixed. And depending on what you know about invariant theory, you might look at that and say, well, degree 1, degree p, product of the degrees is p, order of the group is p, so I'm done. So there are no missing invariants. This is the full ring of invariants. It's a polynomial ring. Yes, this is a reflection representation. In modular invariant theory, reflection representations don't have to have polynomial invariants, but if the invariants are polynomial, you have to have a reflection representation. Okay, so this is a simple elementary example, but this is the sort of thing we want to do. Now we go on and say, well, okay, you could do V2, why can't you do V3, V4, etc.? Well, this is what has been done. Explicit generators are known for the 3, 4, and 5 dimensional representation for all primes. But 6 is open. You can stick it into a computer for a small prime, but we don't have descriptions for arbitrary primes. If you try to put these bits and pieces together, you can do any number of copies of a two-dimensional representation. That's fine. You can do 2 plus 3, 2 V3s, 2 V2s, and a V3, and that's it. Historically, I guess, the n equals 3 case can be found in Dixon's work, so 1913, at that time he's writing an expository article, so it must have been earlier than 1913, but it's certainly around then. 4 and 5 were my work about 10 years ago. MV2 was Campbell-Hughes in the 90s, and the 2 plus the others are fairly recent works, usually driven by some other motivation, but that's what we know. So why is this a difficult problem? Why do we get stuck even with, say, a six-dimensional representation? I would say go to Magma or Maple, and they can they can do it for small primes, and you can that's probably better than writing out a table. Dixon did the four-variable case in primes 5, and one of his students did it in prime 7. But okay, so why is this hard? So let's actually have a stab at explaining why this might be a difficult problem. So let's talk about depth and projective dimension for a moment or two. So certainly in modular invariant theory, the standard approach is to try to find a homogeneous system of parameters and then view the ring of invariants as a finite module over the homogeneous system of parameters. So I've just given you the definition of a homogeneous system of parameters. Keep in mind the dimension of the representation is n, so I want algebraically independent elements such that the ring of invariants is finite as a module over this subring. Our standard sort of tool. Now, you could ask for the projective dimension of this finite module. So by that I mean the length of a minimal free resolution as an H module where H is this subring. Now it turns out that the projective dimension doesn't depend on the choice of the system of parameters, so I drop the system of parameters from the notation. And I guess I think you should view the projective dimension as a measure of how complicated the ring is going to be and how difficult the calculation is going to be. So if we have a free module, which means a Cohen-Macaulay ring, then things are fairly straightforward. You find that you've got the whole structure once you have the generators. If you have projective dimension 1, it's a little bit more complicated. Maybe projective dimension 2 should be further complicated, etc. And so the projective dimension is telling you how hard a problem this should be. Now, of course, you're used to the idea of Cohen-Macaulay being defined in terms of depth, and we have the Auchlander-Buxbaum formula telling you how to relate projective dimension and depth. So the difference between the curl dimension and the projective dimension is the depth in this case. And we have a nice result by Ellingsrud and Shilbred to tell us exactly what the depth should be. In terms of the dimension of the fixed point space, so something you can read off pretty quickly. So let's go back and think of our simple examples, the V sub n's, and use Auchlander-Buxbaum and Ellingsrud-Shilbred, and that tells you the projective dimension. And if you go back and look at the list, essentially if it's projective dimension 1 or 2, you have a hope. In most of the other cases, you don't. So we've done essentially the projective dimension 1 and 2 cases. And once it gets to projective dimension 3, it seems to be beyond us at present. So that's my quick explanation of why we can do what we can do and why we run into trouble with the bigger representations, that they are getting more and more complicated and harder to get our hands on. Okay, so that's the problem and why it might be a difficult problem. Let's think about how we might attack the problem. Now, I'll just for the moment slip into a slightly more general setting, but we'll eventually fairly quickly get back to our cyclic group. The transfer or trace is a standard tool in the invariant theory of finite groups. I mean, there are analogs, of course, in the infinite group case. You sum over the group Now, for non-modular representations, this gives you a surjection from the symmetric algebra to the ring of invariants. You construct every invariant as a transfer. But when you work with modular representations, you kill off every invariant you plug into the system because you've multiplied by the order of the group, which is zero in the field. So what you end up with is not a surjective map, but something still useful for construction and something which gives you an ideal in the ring of invariants. So maybe this should actually be more interesting. Now you've got an ideal in a ring and there's all sorts of interesting things you might do with this ideal. So we're going to think of for this talk mostly we're going to think of it as a way of constructing invariants, but you can also view it as an interesting sort of general tool in invariant theory. Okay, so how can we use this ideal in our case? How much of what's going on should we recover from the transfer? Again, I'm just sort of reiterating my previous notation. I want the x's to be a basis so that sigma is acting on the dual in Jordan form. And I can actually tell you what the radical of the image of the transfer is from a sort of geometric point of view. It's essentially you take all of the variables except the last one, you look at the ideal that generates in the polynomial ring, and then you intersect with the ring of invariants. And that gives you the radical of the image of the transfer. And it's not difficult to show that if you take the quotient by the radical, you're just left with polynomial algebra in the norm of the last variable. So that's telling you that the radical is giving you everything except the norm. So if you can compute generators for the radical, you're in good shape. Of course, it's easier to compute the transfer, not the radical of the transfer. Okay, so let's think a little bit about how we might go about computing the image of the transfer. So pick a graded subalgebra of the invariant ring and make sure that it contains a system of parameters so that the extension is finite. Take the quotient by the ideal generated by the positive degree element. So this A sub plus is the ideal of positive degree elements in A, but we want to look at what the ideal generated in the full polynomial ring. So since the extension was finite, A to FVG is finite, FVG to FV is finite, so the full extension is finite. When we take the quotient, we get a finite dimensional algebra. You find a basis for that algebra, lift it up, and you get module generators for FV over A. And you keep in mind that the transfer map takes you from the polynomial ring to the invariant ring, commutes with invariants, so commutes with the elements of A because of how they've been constructed. So we take A module generators for the polynomial ring. We apply the transfer. We get A module generators for the image of the transfer. And this is a pretty good step towards describing the image of the transfer. If we actually take A to be the full ring of invariants, then this quotient is called the ring of co-invariants. And you apply this argument, you see that the top degree of the ring of co-invariants gives you the top degree of a possible, or gives you an upper bound on the degrees of the generators for the image of the transfer. So that's a useful tool. In a sense, it's telling you that the computing the image of the transfer is a relatively constructive sort of thing to do. You can pick a suitable A, write down the module generators, apply the transfer. It might get difficult or messy, but it's a straightforward sort of process. So we tend to think of the image of the transfer as something you can get your hands on if you have patience and if your computer is big enough and fast enough. Okay, so that's our first tool. How do we finish off the process? So let's see. Let's start about there. So this is a slightly more folksy title, I guess, Rational Norms and Transfers. We'll see what this means in a minute or two. Keeping in mind that if you take this quotient by the radical, the only thing that's left was the norm in the last variable. So this last variable is playing a rather special role, and the norm is playing a rather special role. So it's a polynomial whose lead term is xn to the pth power. And we can think of these things as polynomials in xn, and the other variables get shuffled into the coefficient. So think about the degree as a polynomial in xn and just apply division algorithm. So give me any polynomial, divide through by n, or say homogeneous, and you end up with something that has low degree and a remainder and a quotient and the rest of it. So that gives me this decomposition. I guess maybe I can try to use this. Is this going to work or not? So we take your arbitrary polynomial, we do the division, you get some remainder, and you get the rest of it lying over here. Clearly, this is a decomposition of vector spaces. This is obviously an FG, or an F, a module over the group ring. What's slightly unusual is that B itself is also a module over the group ring. And this is because sigma can't increase the degree of a polynomial in Xn. It can convert, it can sort of produce smaller variables, but it can't produce new Xn. So the degree never goes up. So the division works nicely with respect to computing invariants. So you get a decomposition of the symmetric algebra as a module over the group ring in terms of sort of low degree in Xn plus things that are, sometimes we use the word, propagated by the norm. So this is a rather useful decomposition, made further useful by some work, Onquist and Fossum and Hughes-Kemper, which tell us that if you go up high enough, the BD is projective. Now, projective modules are nice. This should be useful, but it also ties in nicely with the whole business of the transfer. One of the things to keep in mind is that each one of our indecomposable modules has a single one-dimensional fixed-point space. So there's a correspondence between bases for the invariants and decompositions, and which invariants are in the image of the transfer, precisely the ones that are fixed points of projective modules. So that's telling you that once you get above this degree, the only somehow interesting indecomposable invariants are coming from projective modules and therefore are in the image of the transfer. So in high degrees, you're either decomposable or you're in the image of the transfer. Okay, so we need the norm of the last variable. We will take the image of the transfer, which should take care of the large degree in decomposable invariants, and we're stuck fussing about which elements, trying to find the radical in low degrees. Now, one approach to this is to look at Almquist's paper. Oh, I've got it in front of me. I love it. Invariants mostly old. I've added quotes to isomorphic because, of course, it would be not. I mean, there's no sensible way of thinking of those things as being isomorphic. The point is they have the same dimension, and there's something sort of slightly stronger than that going on. Let's see. Think of doing the following, working with your n variables but taking integer coefficients, and project down and work with the field of p elements. So this is just projection mod p. Include in here, or if you like, we could even go all the way to the complex numbers. Now, sigma is acting here by a matrix that has integer entries. So let it act here or here. We might fuss a little bit about how you want to choose your bases and whether you've really chosen the right way to represent sigma. But the idea is if you take an invariant here, it's going to project to an invariant there. And it's going to include to an invariant over here. So you can think of trying to construct invariants here and then hope that they actually have rational coefficients and clear denominators and then project down to get invariants here. And what Almquist tells you is that with the right choices, you get that the dimension here is the same as the dimension there if you take the prime much larger than the degree of the polynomials that you're looking at. So they're isomorphic as vector spaces, except the fields are wrong, but you know, the dimensions are right. Maybe you should also say if you take the prime really large, aren't there computer algebra systems that actually say don't compute over the rationals, they just pick a really big prime. So maybe philosophically picking a really big prime should be more or less the same as doing that calculation. Okay. Well, approach to this, I sort of discovered Almquist after I had worked on the problem for a little while. When you construct invariants, you come across low-degree invariants that are independent of the prime. I mean, typically you should write down an invariant and expect that the prime should play some role. But you seem to come across a few invariants, typically in low degree, which are essentially integer invariants, but you're looking at them down here. You have to pick your coefficients right, but you end up with something which is that you see for every single prime, sort of prime-independent invariant, and that's what I mean by rational invariant. I mean, thought of as something that somehow should be invariant over the rational numbers. Okay. Now, if you read a little bit more of Fossum and then start to go back and read Sylvester and Hilberton. Yeah. That's right. That's it. So, in fact, you can go back and look in Sylvester, see the tables, what, you know, he's telling you about covariance. You pick the source of the covariant, that's a unipotent invariant, you maybe take a little bit of care of how you choose your bases, and you arrange for the coefficients to be integers, and then you reduce mod p, and you get an invariant. So this is one way of picking up some low-degree prime-independent invariants. The conjecture is that the transfers these rational invariants and the norm should give you everything. Verified in all cases where we know the answer, but of course we don't know the answer in very many examples. But here's one example that I think is quite nice. If we go to any one of the classic sources and look at the binary cubic, you should get covariance, the form, the Hessian, and two transvectants. Pick out the sources of the covariance, choose your bases appropriately, and you work through and you get, well, I've written the first one, the x1, that's obviously invariant and obviously prime independent, and obviously comes from the form, if you interpret this correctly. The second guy comes from the Hessian. The third and fourth guy I haven't written out explicitly. They're starting to get a bit messy, but you know, you can certainly write them down. The three is a bit of an oddity. You really have to keep the three if you want it to be prime, you know, properly invariant for every single prime, because there are other coefficients along the way that aren't divisible by three. I mean, I've written the lead term. I'm using an order with x1 less than x2 less than x3, etc., and then graded Revlex. Okay, so, yes, if you sit down and do the calculation, these, what do we have, 1, 2, 3, 4, rational invariants, the image of the transfer and the norm give you your generating set. And this is, I mean, this sort of approach is partly to put the messiness into the image of the transfer, because you get the number of generators is dependent on the prime. It's a big generating set, but most of them are transfers. Okay. So maybe you were saying this is the wrong problem. We shouldn't be trying to construct, I mean, it's an open-ended problem. We construct generators for one, then we go on to the next, we go on to the next, we go on to the next. Maybe it's just too messy and we're looking at the wrong sort of problem. So if you take a step back, we can try to say, well, maybe if you don't, it's too messy to give you an explicit generating set, but I'll give you a degree bound. I'll say that the invariants are, the generating set can be chosen in degrees less than or equal to a certain degree. So we'll talk about the Noether number of the representation as the largest degree of an element in a minimal set of homogeneous generators. Of course, the minimal set of homogeneous generators isn't unique, but the degrees are unique. So you know, we could rephrase this if we want, but essentially we want to find a minimal set and you know, look at the top degree, except we'd like to do that without having the minimal set in front of us. So, Noether tells us that in the non-modular case, or sorry, in characteristic zero, the order of the group is a global bound. And Peter Fleischmann and John Fogarty say, well, as you might have expected, non-modular is good enough. Characteristic zero isn't essential, although there's, you know, 85 years between the two results. And Richmond tells us, yeah, but in modular invariant theory, you don't have a hope. There's no global bound. You have to take account the representation. You can fix the group and find representations with arbitrarily high Noether numbers. So can you bound things? And Dirks and Kemper give you a nice, rather messy, doubly exponential thing that no one believes is anywhere near sharp, but it works. And Karagazian and Simons take a slightly different route, and they say fix the dimension and fix the field and make the field finite, and then there are only finitely many representations to worry about, and we can construct an upper bound that works there. And Bram has given us a bound for the Cohen-Macaulay case, and I think some people perhaps believe that should be the bound in general, but I think we're a ways away from proving that. And if you know something else about your representation, the Goebel tells us permutation representations are, you know, are nice and have nice bounds. So that's my quick summary of what's known in general. What can we say about our cyclic group of order P case? Maybe I'll just... And I'm quite pleased and was somewhat surprised that we were able to do this, but here we go. If you look at a whole bunch of V2s, then we can go to Campbell-Hughes and read off an Oether number from the generating set. But what do we do in the other cases? Well, we have some new work that gives you the answer. So we have we don't know the generating sets except for a few special cases, but we can give you not a bound on the Noether number, but precisely what the Noether number is for every other representation of the cyclic group of order P. So I should explain this a little bit. We need to count the number of non-trivial sum n's in our V. The trivial sum n's don't add to the Noether number. You can throw them away or put them in. It doesn't change the answer. And our answer breaks down into two cases. Either you have a sum n that's large, meaning greater than 3, or you don't. If you have a large sum n, then you get an Oether number of p minus 1 times k plus p minus 2. If you only have small sum n's, it's p minus 1 times k plus 1. Of course, you have no v3s, then you're back in the essentially k times p minus 1. So essentially, you get p minus 1 for each sum n, and then a minor little sort of error term. Now, in fact, the calculations had strongly suggested that if you picked a single sum end and the sum end was large, you should get 2p minus 3 as the Noether number. So that was actually what we were working on. We were trying to prove, just look at indecomposables and show that the answer was 2p minus 3. And we got very excited when we made a breakthrough and then realized that the same technique would work for anything if you just did the bookkeeping properly. So that's the Noether number for any representation, of a modular representation of a cyclic group of order P. And if you compare it to the Dirksen-Kemper bound, you see it's much, much lower than you somehow had a right to expect. But maybe that's the first bit of positive news we have. So I wanted to say a little bit about the proof, just sort of to answer the question, how do you compute a Noether number if you don't have a generating set? So I'll just look at the first case, because I think that's the more interesting one and the more general one. So we're going to assume that we have a sum end of size n with n at least or greater than 3, so at least 4. And we'll start by finding a lower bound, and then we're going to find an upper bound, and the two will match. And that's going to be our proof. So we go back to some work with David. If V, let's say V and W are modular representations of the cyclic group of order P and W is a sub-representation, then the Noether number of W is less than or equal to the Noether number of V. Now, for modular representations, this is trivially true. You semi-simple thing split, it works nicely. This is the only modular case in which I think a result of this is known. We prove it for cyclic group of order P, and we work relatively hard. We don't have a result for cyclic of order P squared or P cubed or anything like that. We have no examples where this sort of result fails, but we don't have theorems that tell you that it works. But since it does work, this is useful. And you do need less than or equal to, because if you look back to the last stage, you see once you get above, V4 has Noether number 2p minus 3, the next one is 2p minus 3, the next one is 2p minus 3. They're not getting any bigger. Okay, so the trick here is to say, well, if you've got something, if you've got k pieces, and one of the key pieces is size 4 or bigger, then you've got a sub-representation consisting of a 4 and a bunch of v2s. And if I can find a Noether number for that, or even a lower bound for the Noether number for that, it becomes a lower bound for my representation. Okay, so now we'll look at this explicit example, and we'll choose a nice basis. So I can't use just x's anymore. I've got w's and x's for the v2's, and then an x, y, z, w at the end for the 4. And the action is sort of what you'd expect. It's a bunch of little two blocks and a four block. And we compute a transfer. And we do a bit of fuss, and we show that this transfer can't decompose. So the Noether number has to be at least that. And the proof is on induction on K, the number of pieces. And K equals 1 reduces to the four-dimensional representation, which is something we did about 10 years ago. And so we can actually look in that case, and it really is indecomposable in that case. So that gives us a lower bound, K times P minus 1 plus P minus 2. So now we need an upper bound. So going back to Hughes and Kemper, my understanding, Omquist and Fossum work with indecomposables, and Hughes and Kemper sort of generalized their results as sums of things. And so at this stage, we actually need the full-blown Hughes-Kemper result rather than the older Omquist-Fossum result. So remember, the point was in high degree, everything was projective or decomposable, and projective means image of the transfer. And now we actually need to know exactly how high you have to go up, but we look at, it turns out the Hughes-Kemper result tells you that once you get past K times P minus 1 minus dim V minus K, all of your indecomposables come from projectives and are therefore in the image of the transfer. And that's smaller than on the lower bound that we're worrying about, so anything that's above our lower bound has to be in the image of the transfer. So that's what we want to do, look at the image of the transfer. And so now I'm back to repeating myself, only I'm using slightly different notation. We look at the Hilbert ideal. So this is the ideal in the polynomial ring generated by the homogeneous invariants of positive degree. We take the quotient to get the co-invariants. A homogeneous basis for the co-invariants lifts to a generating set for the symmetric algebra as a module over the ring of invariants. Module generators transfer to generators for the image of the transfer. So if we can compute the top degree of the co-invariance, that gives us an upper bound on generators coming from the image of the transfer, which will give us an upper bound on indecomposables. So now we just have to show that the top degree of the co-invariance is less than or equal to this number, which is the same number we had before. And it's an amusing sort of combinatorial argument that tells you what the lead term of an element from the image of the transfer can look like. So you actually reduce it not, you just need to know the Hilbert series or Hilbert polynomial, if you like, for that, which is the same as that. So if you can tell me which lead terms can appear in the Hilbert ideal and which ones can't. So in a certain sense, it's kind of now become a Grödner basis calculation in the Hilbert ideal. But of course, you don't have a generating set for the Hilbert ideal. Okay, and we're at this stage done. And the other case is similar, but in a sense simpler, because it just deals with smaller representations. So I guess I've spoken a little bit quickly, but I've covered what I wanted to cover. Thank you for your attention. Sorry, what you want to look at this product, the full modular there's quite a bit is known. The Hughes-Kemper paper I think is a good place to look. They have quite good description of the symmetric